This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 164 was recorded on April 25th, 2019. I'm Eric Townsend. I want to thank everyone who wrote in with feedback and suggestions on where we might find an expert with contrasting views to Jeff Snyder's Eurodollar thesis. Two names that came up repeatedly were Zoltan Pozsar and Perry Merling. We've already reached out to both of them with interview invitations. This week's feature interview guest will be Hoisington's chief economist, Dr. Lacey Hunt. We'll discuss Dr. Hunt's outlook for the U.S. and global economy, recession risk, and, of course, where they're allocating on the yield curve. And be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment after the feature interview, when we'll have extended Forex and bond market coverage and another of Patrick's famous chart books.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, that S&P 500 is literally pivoting off of the double top retest and has not shown any signs of going higher or lower. Which one is it? What's your thinking?
Well, that's clearly the operative question. As I said last week, the really important tell here is going to be, do we get a failed rally shy of the previous high? And in order to call it a failed rally, we'd have to see a significant move down, not just the little blip we had this morning. Are we going to see that, or are we going to see a retest double top scenario where the market kind of doesn't go substantially higher, at least initially, or are we going to see just a breakthrough to new highs? That really is going to be an important tell, and we don't quite have the answer yet. So far as I can see, I think this tape still has some momentum to it. Now, that's totally at odds with my fundamental view. If the market was listening to me, it should have rolled over to the downside a long time ago. I think we're headed into recession. I think economic conditions are worsening. I think bond yields are telling us where the market is eventually going to head. But so far, they're not listening to me. I don't have any reason to think they're suddenly going to tune in this week and, Eric told them the market should go down and start selling. So I won't be surprised if we get at least a retest and maybe even a breakout to new all-time highs. Doesn't make any sense, but if I look at the tape, I don't really see signs of exhaustion or reversal here, at least not yet.
All right, well, let's move on to the U.S. dollar index because, well, it looks like it's moving. What's your thinking?
Woohoo! Daily close over 97 spot 50 is precisely the signal that we've been talking about and waiting for weeks and weeks and weeks. And we finally got it. But of course, as the old saying goes, one day does not make a new trend. To my surprise, some of our favorite people, some of our past guests on the program are fading this move, recommending that their clients short the dollar here. That's a pretty gutsy call. I think that what we're looking at is a long consolidation that we've finally seen a breakout north of. This looks healthy to me. I think we're headed higher. I think we're headed above 100 on the dollar index, and I am very surprised that some people who I have a lot of respect for are fading this and think that this is a fake break and we're going the other way. I will acknowledge that one day does not make a trend, so let's wait and see how it looks next week. But certainly, if we stay above 97.50 for the next week, that really says to me that the move is on and that we're headed toward higher numbers. But Patrick, this is an important signal for sure. So I think what we need to do is go the next level on this and dive into not just what's the dollar index doing, but what's the euro and all of the other currency pairs that make it up. So let's come back to this subject in postgame. And I know you've prepared an excellent chart book getting into the individual currency pairs so we can look at what's going on behind this move in the dollar.
Absolutely. So I wanted to, though, touch on to crude oil because I wanted your take on this. I'm personally shocked at how relentless the rise has been in oil. Today, we see the first down day. We're trading somewhere close to $65 at the time of recording here. What's your take on this? Does oil still have more gas in the tank?
Well, the catalyst for this latest push up was clearly news coming out over the weekend that the United States was not going to renew exemptions that they had granted to Iranian oil sanctions. Now, at first, it sounded like, you know, that's it. The jig is up. There's no more. And then it became clearer into the week, maybe in reaction to how quickly the price moved up. They said, well, actually, we're phasing it out over the next, you know, 6 months to a year. So it's not happening overnight. In any case, that news seems to have been the catalyst for this latest wave higher. I do think that the market looks tired. We're seeing signs of exhaustion in the tape. But frankly, we've been tricked by a few bear traps in the past. Patrick, as we came into the pit close on Thursday afternoon at 2:30, there was a sudden puke and dramatically lower prices. Looks to me like somebody was trying to bang the close and get a number below the five-day moving average on today's close. Now, there could have been some fundamental news that came out that I just haven't seen yet. That only happened a half an hour ago. We're recording around 3 o'clock right now. But so far, you know, that move below the five seems to have stabilized after the close. It isn't continuing to sell off. So it looks to me like that was more of last minute tape action before the close as opposed to new fundamental news driving the market. We're still above the 8 and 13 day moving averages. It looks to me like we could see the beginnings here of a rollover. But boy, how many times have I said that in the last couple of months only for the market to power higher? So I'm not going to short this thing until I see a daily close below the 5, 8, and 13 day moving averages and really get confidence that the move is over. But I do think that the tape is looking kind of tired here. And from a fundamental standpoint, I think it should be rolling over. It's just I've been caught wrong-footed too many times to take the risk of a short right here.
Eric, how did those inventory numbers come in?
Well, crude oil building 5.4 million barrels. Needless to say, that is a good reason to explain why the tape seems to be running out of steam here. But this sudden move down that we saw into Thursday's close was not a reaction to inventory. Going back to the inventory numbers, Cushing, Oklahoma, building 463,000 barrels. Gasoline drawing down 2.1 million barrels. Distillates drawing down 662,000 barrels. So that big build in crude inventory offset slightly by a gasoline draw, but not nearly as big as the build in crude. I think that's why the market kind of ran out of steam for the last couple of days after inventory. But frankly, we've seen this pattern before where a bullish inventory report seemed to be putting in a top in the market. There was weakness for a day or two, and then it just powered higher. So it'll be really interesting to see what Friday's tape action brings us. We moved back up to 12.2 million barrels of U.S. production. That is an all-time high. It's not a new all-time high. We hit that all-time high several weeks ago. We ticked down to 12.1. Now we're back up to 12.2. It's going to be really important to watch U.S. production. Some declines in the rig count have suggested, and I think this has led in part to some of the bullish speculation that we see in the market. A lot of people are concluding, okay, rig count is rolling over. That means production is about to top out and start going precipitously down. I think that speculation is driving the market. Are we really going to see production top out here and start moving back below 12 million barrels, or is it going to stay stable to higher? That's going to be really important to watch in coming weeks. In any event, let's see what happens.
All right, well, let's move on to gold, because with the dollar move the way it's happening, I would have thought we would have seen a bigger response from the shiny metal, and it seems to be flat on the day in spite of this big dollar move. What's your thinking here?
That definitely is what has caught my attention as well. I don't have an explanation for it, but, you know, boy, this breakout in the dollar, I was expecting that to be the signal that was going to green light the next move lower in gold. And we actually saw, as the dollar was breaking through 97.5, gold was up on the day, and it's retraced some of that now. But, you know, boy, why are we seeing, is it the beginning of that new regime that we've been predicting would eventually occur, where gold and the dollar move up together on a secular basis? Well, we kind of thought that was starting a couple months ago. We talked about that, and just as we were talking ourselves into it, we saw some moves where both the dollar and gold were moving down on the same day. So the correlation is not as reliable as it used to be, and to my surprise, we're seeing that strength. I don't have an explanation, but I'm watching it closely.
Well, let's move on to the 10-year treasury yields, because we've dropped now down to about the 253 level on the yield on Thursday at the time of recording. And we certainly are off of the higher levels from last week. You think this is a key turn point here in the yield?
Yeah, I really do think that it is. If we look at going back several months to what the pattern has been, we were stuck between 2.60 and 2.80 on the 10-year yield for I forget how long. When we broke through 2.60 to the downside, higher in price, lower in yield, we went all the way from 2.60 to, what was it, 2.37, 2.38 in a matter of a week or two. So there was that sudden break. Well, what happens when you have a really important break? Oftentimes, as you know in technical analysis, Patrick, what was previously resistance has to be retested as support. So after getting all the way down to the high 2.30s, we came back to, I don't know if it touched 2.60 this week. It certainly was within a couple of basis points of that, 258, 259 in there somewhere, basically retesting that 2.60 previous resistance level in price, support level in yield, now testing it from the other side. It seems to have held. We're moving in the other direction, 2.53 as we're speaking on Thursday afternoon. Really says to me the next test is, can we get back down below 2.40 again and continue this move? So as I said last week, I think the buy the dip opportunity was that retest of 2.60, and I think we're headed lower from here in yield. Certainly, Dr. Lacey Hunt, I think, will agree with that view, although his views tend to be much longer term and not so much focused on what's going to happen in the next few weeks. I think that the signals we're seeing are that that 260 that was previously a support level in yield, a resistance level in price, is now working in the opposite direction. And I think that the next big test will be a closing print below 2.40, especially a weekly close below 2.40 would really confirm that we're headed higher in price, lower in yield.
All right. Well, this week's featured interview guest is Hoisington's chief economist, Dr. Lacey Hunt. Now, Eric, why did we invite Dr. Hunt back this week?
Well, last time we had him on the program, he was the lone voice. Almost everybody in the industry was screaming at the top of their lungs, look at the 10-year breaking north of 3.10. This has to mean the sky is falling, the world is coming to an end. We're headed back to a secular bear market in bonds with higher yields. And Dr. Hunt was just incredibly calm, cool, and collected and said, you know, it's lonely sometimes, but I'm sticking to my fundamental view. There's too much debt in the system. It doesn't make sense. And I think this is a false breakout and it's not going to last. Needless to say, he's been proven right at this point. So I want to get his perspective on where we're headed from here, what the economy looks like, what it's going to mean for other markets. And before I even had a chance to bring up the question of modern monetary theory, he brought it up. And so it's going to be a fascinating interview.
All right. Well, Eric's interview with Dr. Lacey Hunt is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next on the program is Dr. Lacey Hunt, chief economist at Hoisington Asset Management. Dr. Hunt, before we get started, I just want to credit you and make sure our audience is aware. The last time that you were on this program, everybody and his brother was screaming at the top of their lungs, okay, look, that's it. It's clear the bond bull market is clearly over. We're headed to much higher yields. The big number that everybody was watching was 3.10 on the 10-year yield. And so many people said, boy, if we get past that, there's no turning back. It's the end of the world. Sky's falling. That's it for the bond market. And just as that was happening, we had you on the program. I believe it was the same week that we first broke 3.10. And you were very confident, very assured, and just saying, look, it's lonely sometimes, but I'm sticking to my story. My fundamental view has not changed. It is very much opposite consensus, and this is a buying opportunity for bonds, not a reason to panic. That was so out of consensus at the time, and needless to say, you have been proven spot on correct ever since then. And I also want to just make our listeners aware, this is not the first time that you've been out of consensus and correct. You caught all of the major bull and bear markets in the bond market since the late 1970s. So congratulations for the excellent track record, and thanks so much for joining us again on the program.
Well, it's my pleasure, Eric. Great to be with you, and thanks for remembering my record.
Well, it's my pleasure to have you back. Let's for some of our newer listeners, let's start by briefly reviewing your outlook for the economy, what you think is going to come next for both the U.S. economy and the global economy, and then we can get into a little bit more on the fixed income markets.
Well, the overriding concern for us is that the U.S. economy and all of the major other players in the global economy are extremely over-indebted. And this debt is a hindrance to growth. It is also a factor that retards inflation and is the main ingredient that has controlled the environment of low interest rates for an elongated period of time. And it has been our view that trying to solve an indebtedness problem by taking on more debt is not the solution, that it only aggravates. You can take on more debt, as we have done so many times, and there is a transitory benefit to the economy, but the benefit fades very quickly. And as a result of that, the transitory spurts in economic activity, inflation, which do occur, are relatively short-lived. And they give way to periods of weaker economic activity and lower inflation, lower interest rates. And as long as the indebtedness problem remains at the forefront of the domestic and global economic situation, it's our view that we're going to continue to persist with this lower inflation and interest rate environment for a longer period of time.
And what is your outlook, say, for the next 6 to 12 months for the U.S. economy? A lot of people are saying we're headed for a recession. Would you agree with that view?
Well, the economy is very weak. We're in a downturn. The economy held up reasonably well in the first quarter, principally because of a very substantial drop in the current account deficit, which contributed about 1% to GDP growth in the first quarter. And also a very sizable increase in inventory investment in the first quarter after a large contribution to growth from inventories in the fourth quarter. So the first quarter's growth rate will start off somewhere around 2.5%, which is more or less about the same as it was in the fourth quarter. But more forward-looking elements of the economy deteriorated. The rate of growth in consumer spending was only 1.5% annual rate in the first quarter, down from 2.5% in the fourth quarter. And in fact, it looks like the six-month rate of growth in real consumer spending for the latest six-month period is approximately the weakest since 2013, which is a very significant statement. The gain in the trade sector and the buildup in inventories are likely reverse as we move into the second and third quarters. And by the end of the year, I think growth will be only barely positive, perhaps even stationary. So we're peaking in terms of the growth rate in the first quarter, and we're set to move significantly lower in the second, third, and fourth quarters of the year. And a couple of things that we're looking at that suggest this. The Federal Reserve has engineered a very significant monetary deceleration, one that has reduced the rate of growth in bank credit and money supply in the United States to very weak levels. And the Federal Reserve's restrictive policy has reduced a world dollar liquidity, which has in turn caused a major monetary deceleration in Europe, Japan, and China. And the Fed's restraint has also resulted in a synchronized global downturn. In fact, the downturn is more significant in Europe, Japan, than in the United States. Now, a lot of folks are optimistic because the Chinese pumped in a record amount of new debt in the first 3 months of this year, and they're assuming that this huge surge in Chinese debt will lift the Chinese economy, and the Chinese economy will provide some propulsion to the global economy. But one of our critical points is that when one looks at the production function, of the U.S. and the global function and the global economy. The overuse of a factor of production such as debt capital results in diminishing returns at some point. And we think the Chinese economy is at that point. And so, contrary to most folks that are very optimistic about China's growth picking up significantly as we go through the year, we expect that the huge injection in debt will be very short-lived and that the Chinese economy will falter as we move into the latter part of the year. And we think this synchronized global downturn is going to be very, very difficult to shake. A couple of things that we're looking at on the monetary side. Last year, at the end of the year, the M2 money supply growth was 4.2%, which was in the lower quintile of growth rates on an annual basis since the end of World War II. And as of the first week in April, the rate of growth in M2 has decelerated even further, down to just 3.9%, which is only about half of the long-term rate of increase in M2 since 1900. It's a very, very weak rate of growth. And in addition, bank credit growth has decelerated, as one might expect. The yield curve has flattened very considerably, and this tends to undermine the profitability of those that are borrowing short and lending long. And so the monetary policy is constrictive. The benefits from last year's big increase in the federal budget, which funded a household tax cut, a corporate tax cut, and also a fairly sizable bipartisan increase in spending, we think that those benefits, which were debt financed, are largely behind us. And diminishing returns will also take over there as well. So we're at the best rate of growth now, and the growth rate is going to get progressively weaker as we move through the rest of the year.
So we're headed down in terms of growth, and obviously for the reasons that you stated at the very beginning of this interview, that should be constructive for bond prices, meaning lower yields. Do you have a forecast, a rate forecast that you work with for what we should expect in terms of both U.S. and foreign yields, or do you only work in terms of the expected direction?
Well, we're really only good at direction. We try to make a multi-year assessment, but I did a little exercise that I will share with you. We looked at three significant monetary decelerations that occurred in the post-war period when the Federal Reserve managed to avoid a full-scale recession, but there was a quasi-recession. So the Fed engineered a slowdown in money and credit growth such as they have today. The yield curve flattened significantly, in some cases actually inverted. But a recession did not ensue. And those three cases were in 1966 and 67, 1984 and 1986, and then from 1995 to 1999. Now, in each of those cases, the economy got very shaky, and there was also a financial failure as a result of the monetary restraint. In the 1960s, it was the failure of Westick, also known as Western Equities. In 1984, it was the failure of the Penn Square National Bank and the great Continental Illinois National Bank. And then in the late 90s, it was the failure of long-term capital management. But in each of those cases, the Federal Reserve moved rather quickly, and on average, they cut the federal funds rate by 300 basis points. Even with that, the inflation rate fell by about 130 basis points. Now, here is the difficulty. In those earlier cases where the Fed faced a weakening economic situation, the demographics were better than they are today. Population growth is at an 80-year low. The economy was not nearly as overleveraged as it is today, and the global economy was considerably stronger. So those earlier cases presented the Fed with a better opportunity to get out of the mess, but today, the Fed is not in a position to lower the federal funds rate by 300 basis points. We would be constrained by the lower bound. And a drop of 130 basis points in the inflation rate would take the inflation rate down to, to 5 or 6/10 of 1%, which would mean that there would be some important sectors of the economy that would be in actual deflation. And so the risk is that in the process of trying to contain the slowdown as it moves along this year, we will go back to the zero bound for the policy rates, and they will be stuck there for a multi-year period, much as we've seen in Japan and Europe. And that is the main risk in the interest rate environment as we see it.
Now, obviously, they can only go as far as the zero bound until they have to consider other mechanisms of unconventional monetary policy. Do you expect once we get to the zero bound that there's a pause there and they don't go back to quantitative easing? Or do you think that as soon as we get to the zero bound, if the conditions warrant further easing, they go right to more QE?
I think that they will take some type of extraordinary measures. I think quantitative easing proved basically ineffective, but because it's an option, a lever they can pull, it's quite possible that they would do so. But here is the risk. The unconventional methods suggest that we will then be stuck at the zero bound for a prolonged period of time, just as we've seen in Europe and Japan.
And what is your expectation as to how the economy, I guess you could make the argument, okay, once you're at the zero bound, that's the famous situation where it's all over. But of course, as Japan has demonstrated for 30 years now, you can get stuck in this liquidity trap at a zero bound, and where so many people back in the early 90s predicted that Japan was going to completely blow up and, Japanese government bond yields would go through roof as the price collapsed to zero. None of that happened, and they've just sort of stayed in this stagnant economic condition that has persisted for decades. So if we get to returning the U.S. Fed funds rate to zero, and they're considering and maybe using some other extreme methods, how long can that go on before we get to a complete reset kind of situation where the whole system has to come into question?
Well, a lot of folks have made that argument that the indebtedness problem is pointing to some sort of blow up. And that argument has been made in the case of Japan. And that argument has been made in the case of the U.S. And this has caused others to say, well, look, the Cassandras of the debt problem have been wrong because we haven't had a debt blow up. And in fact, people continue to clamor for fixed income, high quality fixed income, government securities in Japan, Europe, and the United States at extremely low or virtually unprecedented levels except for recent years. But I think that analysis misses what history has taught us about extreme over-indebtedness periods. The use of debt triggers diminishing returns, which is derived from the production function. The production function is determined by technology and how it interfaces with the three factors of production, land, labor, and capital. And if you overuse one of the factors of production, initially output will rise. You continue to overuse that factor of production, then output or GDP will fall. And so what we're basically seeing is that the marginal revenue product of debt is falling substantially as more and more debt is piled onto the system. And so the effect of the debt is more insidious. It's more hidden from view than a crisis. But the crisis is there, and the crisis is what's happening to the growth rate and to the standard of living. If you calculate the rate of growth in real GDP per capita, which is the determinant of the standard of living, from the beginning of the Republic in 1790 to 1999, the growth rate was 1.9% per annum. Now, 1999 is a very critical level because that's when a number of almost two dozen different academic studies indicate that debt levels became deleterious in terms of their impact on growth. And it's also the time period in which the GDP generated by debt began to fall precipitously in Europe, Japan, and the United States simultaneously. Since 1999, the per capita GDP growth rate has been 1.2% per annum. In other words, we've lost about 45% of our annual growth rate. Now, I did a little exercise to illustrate this impact. If the GDP growth per capita had been 1.9% in the last 20 years instead of the 1.2, the per capita GDP right now would be approximately $8,000 higher. It would be $64,500 versus $56,700. In other words, the per capita GDP would be 14.6% higher, which would be able to lift economic growth. Economic growth would have been better. It would have been lifted the standard of living, would have given greater enjoyment to people, would have produced more jobs, more corporate profits. And so where the debt is deceptive is that it is undermining the growth rate. To sort of paraphrase T.S. Eliot, the world ends with a whimper, not a bang. It's a longer, slower grind downward. That's the problem of the debt. And that's what we've seen in Japan. In 1989, government debt was 60% of GDP. In 1998, it was 80% of GDP. And today, it's in excess of 210%. And the Japanese have had four recessions in the last 10 years. The growth rate has been so poor that the population growth in Japan, which was very healthy, was stronger than in the United States in the mid-1970s. Their population growth was 1.6%, 1.7% per annum. Last year, their population declined 0.4% per annum, which was a record decline. So you get into this period of overusing debt. The growth rate comes down. There's no crisis in terms of the financial markets erupting, but the growth grinds down. And eventually that undermines the demographics. And that's a problem now for the entire world. This feeds into the production function in an adverse way as well. According to the demographic experts at the UN, the world population growth last year was 1.2% per annum, which is an 80-year low. And in 80 years, in other words, 2100, according to the UN demographers, the world population growth is going to be down to 0.2% per annum. Well, so the world right now is at 1.2, 80-year low. The U.S. population growth last year was 0.6%, half of the world. The European population growth was 0.3%, half of the U.S., a quarter of the world. The Chinese population growth was, let's call it zero. It actually declined slightly for the first time since the 1960s. And then Japan is negative 0.4. And moreover, not only is the population growth deteriorating, Europe, Japan, the United States are getting older. The average population in China is 40 versus 38 in the U.S. because of the one child per family, and they have a mismatch between young men and young women. The average Chinese age is increasing 6 months every 12 months. And this similar pattern, not quite as rapid in Europe. And so we're not only our population growing more slowly, but we have more older people who have less demands for things. Babies and young families are conducive to growth. So if you think of the production function, in the United States, every dollar of public and private debt is generating about 40 cents of GDP growth. In China, it's 36 cents. In Europe, it's 38 cents. And in Japan, it's 27 cents. So using the production function as a gauge of where we're going, the U.S. is going to continue to outperform Europe and Japan, possibly even China, which means that the rest of the world is going to be hanging on us, draining us. And so there is no crisis from the federal debt, but there are very serious long-run developments that are undermining economic growth, the standard of living, and also population. And one other factor that needs to be discussed, the debt-induced weakness in growth is causing an increase in the income and wealth divides. When you get weaker growth, you leave a lot of folks behind. And so there is no crisis in the sense of a blow up, but there are clear, tangible evidences that the over indebtedness is harming the economic prospects, and that the harm is greater outside the United States than inside the United States. But that creates a problem for us.
Okay, so if I can just briefly summarize all of this to make sure that I have your view correct, you're basically saying that, you know, here we go again. We've tried to solve a problem of too much debt with more debt. And just as you can solve a heroin junkie's, withdrawal addiction by giving him more heroin, that works in the very short term, but eventually it just makes the problem worse. We're coming now into, by the end of this year, that next slowdown where the Fed will very quickly be forced to go back to the zero bound with the Fed funds rate. We'll probably have to explore alternative, unconventional means of easing. And this puts us back in a situation where, as you say, we're not facing the conspiracy blogger scenario of the whole world blows up, but rather what we are facing is maybe the entire developed world kind of looks like Japan has looked for the last 20 or 30 years, which is extremely weak economic conditions because the country has been burdened with just too much debt. And it sounds like you're saying that the whole developed world takes on those symptoms and conditions. But just as Japan has not blown up completely, the rest of the world doesn't blow up. We just get stuck in a situation where the entire economy is slave to excessive debt. Is that a fair summary of your views?
I think it is a fair summary, and I think it is correct with historical analysis. The great David Hume, who's known as the father of the Enlightenment, tremendous thinker, Adam Smith, who was mentored by Hume, said he was the greatest intellect of all, wrote a paper in 1752 called Of Public Finance, which is on the internet. You can read it. It's well worth reading. And Hume looked at all of these cases of extremely over-indebted economies up until the point that he wrote the paper. So he looked at the Mesopotamian and Roman empires and a number of much smaller cases that have entirely been forgotten. And this is what he said toward the end of the paper. When a state has mortgaged all of its future revenues, the state lapses into tranquility, languor, and impotence. And so that's the pattern. It's a long, slow grind downward. And this has led me to develop an interest rate theorem that I think is very useful, and it surprises a lot of folks. But my interest rate theorem is that government debt accelerations lead to lower, not higher, long-term government yields. And when the debt levels are already high and there is a acceleration in debt-financed activity, there's a transitory gain in economic activity, but it doesn't last very long. And then the economy weakens. When the economy weakens, then the inflation rate moves lower. And when the marginal revenue product of debt declines as it does today, it pulls the velocity of money down, which results in additional downward pressure on GDP growth. And so the pattern is toward lower rates. And if you do a little simple exercise and graph the long government yields in Europe versus the government debt to GDP ratio, or just put them on a graph, one on the left axis, one on the right, government debt to GDP, the government bond yield on the other. Do the same thing for Europe, do the same thing for China, do the same thing in the U.S. And what do you see? In all cases, the government debt to GDP ratio is rising substantially and the bond yield is declining, that there's a negative correlation, not a positive correlation. And Japan is more pronounced because they have been in this debt cycle longer than all the rest. We're just in various stages of lag behind them, and that's the course. So there's a transitory gain. For example, the big surge in deficit spending last year, it produced an acceleration in GDP growth in the second quarter, a little bit in the third quarter, but by the end of the year, it was really hard to identify. And I think that that's the case. The benefit from debt-financed activity is very fleeting. There is a benefit, but it does not last very long. And that's what we've seen in Japan in numerous cases, and what we've seen in Europe in many cases, and I think we're going to start seeing now in China, when the big surge in debt that they've engineered this year really doesn't produce the results that it has in the past, because we're further along the diminishing returns curve.
Let's focus on that diminishing returns curve, because you said earlier that you expect the Fed, because of economic conditions, to have to take us back to the zero bound. You said because of this diminishing returns curve that it's likely that they will have to do some kind of unconventional policy action, but you said quantitative easing really hasn't been that effective, and of course it is diminishing in its efficacy the bigger the balance sheet gets. So what do you think comes next if it's not quantitative easing? Is it outright debt monetization, or is it something else?
Well, there are some folks out there, mainly the modern monetary theorists, that want to make the liabilities of the Federal Reserve legal tender. In other words, allow the Fed's balance sheet to sort of operate as a cash cow and to pay for the Treasury's bills. The Federal Reserve does not have that authority at present. The 1937 Act, the principal author was Senator Carter Glass of Virginia, who wrote also the Glass-Steagall Act, did not intend to give them that authority. He consulted with Irving Fisher of Yale and Charles Whittlesey of Penn and other great monetary thinkers of the time, and they did not give the Fed that authority. The Fed can only use its balance sheet to buy a select group of assets from the banks, government and agency securities, and then those proceeds have to be held at the Federal Reserve Bank. And so the money supply is equal to the monetary base and the money multiplier, which is endogenous and which the Fed does not control. And regardless of what you have heard, and there was once a statement which was eventually corrected from Ben Bernanke that in quantitative easing, the Fed was printing money, but the Fed does not have that capacity. It doesn't have the mechanism or the tools to print money. For them to be able to print money, you would have to rewrite the Federal Reserve Act. Now, you could go down that route, but what would happen in that case is in very, very short order, we would get hyperinflation, because the aggregate demand curve would shift upward, the money multiplier would no longer be relevant, and prices would rise as fast as the increase in the money supply, and eventually faster. And something called Gresham's Law would take effect. The bad money would chase out the good money. People would not be willing to exchange money for commodities, return to barter. There would be massive inefficiencies. In the old days, when countries made the central bank's liabilities legal tender, we, of course, had many, many smaller producers who maybe somebody produced eggs and someone produced milk and someone else made bread. And you could then sort of barter. But today, we all have specialized skills. It would be hard to barter specialized skills. And then, of course, we have the mass merchandisers that couldn't operate with a barter system. And also, in the past, when the Federal Reserve's liabilities were made legal tender, those currencies were not the reserve currency of the world. And so if we were to do that, it would quickly destabilize the global monetary system. So that's the siren song, and some people are advocating it, but if we were to make the Fed's liabilities legal tender, in very short order, nearly 100% of our people would be miserable, absolutely miserable.
I want to come back to modern monetary theory and some of the directions it could take us in just a minute. But before we go there, let's come back to the current system, the way the laws are written now, the system that we live in. You've described this scenario of worsening economic conditions, the Fed eventually returning to the zero bound, and so forth. Based on that, I know that your process at Hoisington Asset Management is you basically decide where on the curve to allocate long fixed income investments. So how do you translate in the current environment? Is it all about duration risk, that your long duration here and going all the way out on the curve, or is it something different?
Well, we do have a plus 20-year duration, because we've had that for some time. And it's been a bumpy ride. We've had a lot of volatility in the long yields, but let me just give you a perspective. When the Fed first raised the policy rates in December of 2015, the 30-year yield was roughly 3 1/8, and it's been below 3 1/8 since then. It's been above. We had 9 increases in policy rates. We had the euphoria of generally rising stock market. But as things stand, as of the end of March, the best performing part of the Treasury curve was the 30-year. You had a higher coupon, and you outperformed everything on the shorter portion of the curve. In other words, the Treasury market was influenced by a whole host of these transient factors, which were very powerful over the short run, but didn't really matter. But what did matter is that the overall economic growth rate has been subpar, and the inflation rate has generally been depressed and extremely low. Not that there weren't individual bouts in inflation. You can get transitory bouts in growth and inflation, but they're not going to hold in this environment. And so it's been our assessment that the best returning asset on the curve would be the long Treasury. And that's where we've positioned our clients and ourselves, because we invest with our clients.
Okay, so the view in the world as we know it, the current system, is we're in a disinflationary to possibly even deflationary risk scenario. We're in worsening economic conditions. The place to be is all the way out the curve, long duration risk, and that makes perfect sense. Now, I want to come back to your earlier comments about MMT, and let's take it even a step further. You know, one of the things that Neil Howe's work on generational cycles teaches us is that in periods of history like this, we tend to go not only to extreme leaders, but often society will pivot from one extreme to the other. So let's assume that your scenario plays out. The economy worsens through the rest of 2019. We go into the election year of 2020 in either recession conditions or rapidly approaching recession conditions. It's not looking very good for the incumbent party. Suddenly, we end up with President Bernie Sanders, Vice President Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and they appoint Professor Stephanie Kelton as the new Federal Reserve Chairman. Stephanie Kelton, of course, is one of the major proponents of modern monetary theory, the view that it's perfectly okay for the government to create as much money as necessary as long as there's not an immediate inflation risk. It seems to me, and obviously that's an extreme hypothetical. I don't know that we would ever get there. But for sake of argument, let's assume that there is a pivot in social mood to where suddenly more government spending, things like universal basic income, using modern monetary theory to pay for more social spending, forgiveness of student debt, maybe even government subsidized free university tuition, those kinds of things that the political left has begun to focus on sort of come true in terms of those people coming into power. What does that do to your outlook for fixed income? Because obviously those would be very inflationary conditions.
Well, if you make the Fed's liabilities legal tender, then all bets are off. And the inflation rate would begin to rise rapidly, and that would require a different investment strategy. There's no question about that. But if there's an attempt made to rewrite the Federal Reserve Act, you're going to have a little bit of time, because it would have to go to the House and the Senate. They'd have to pass compatible bills and go to the president. Under the right political circumstances, they could do that. But even in the best of circumstances, the process would take a little time. And so that would give investment managers an opportunity to reposition their portfolio. I might also add that the leadership of the Federal Reserve would have to be changed. That could be done as well. But all these things would take time, couldn't be done overnight, because the Fed does not have the current capacity. Now, you might do something like this. You might say, well, we'll have an announcement from the Fed that they will increase the balance sheet. If the deficit is going to be $2 trillion or $3 trillion, they'll increase the Fed's balance sheet $3 trillion. But we already really tried that in 2012 and 2013. The increase in the Fed's balance sheet in those 2 years equaled the budget deficit. But you see, in that particular case, existing under the Federal Reserve Act, the money supply is still equal to the base times little m, the money multiplier. And so you could buy the, you would have the Fed buy the government securities, but the banks would not be able to employ it unless they had the capital to utilize the excess reserves, which was the same problem that constrained the banks from turning the balance sheet into an acceleration in money supply growth. And so when we had quantitative easing, the Fed's balance sheet quadrupled, but the money multiplier dropped from 9 to 3, and the rate of growth in money supply did not accelerate. The only thing that would really be different would be if there was a concerted effort to make the Fed's liabilities legal tender. And my read is that that requires a rewrite of the Federal Reserve Act and also some other companion legislation as well. Could be done under the right political circumstances, but as for the time being, it cannot be done.
And do you see that as, let's say, in the next 2 to 3 years as we go into the next presidential race, if there was a substantial change in national leadership in a new presidential election, do you think that that scenario where the Federal Reserve Act gets rewritten as you describe, is that a 1% possibility or is that a 70% possibility?
I think it's very low because keep in mind that even advocates of greater budget deficits, such as Paul Krugman and Larry Summers, have said that modern monetary theory is not workable. There's an outstanding article by Ken Rogoff at Harvard about the unworkability and what it would mean for higher inflation. So I don't see mainstream academic economists supporting it. And I certainly don't see the Federal Reserve community, the Chairman Powell has come out against it. It would take a cataclysmic political shift to want to rewrite the Federal Reserve Act to do that.
Okay, so we'll categorize that as an extreme outlier, but still a plausible risk, considering that we're in a very interesting economic environment. That's sobering news, to say the least.
It would make everybody's life miserable, including fixed income managers and everyone else in the economy, because you would barter. And barter is extremely inefficient. The aggregate supply curve would turn vertical. So every time that they expanded the Fed's balance sheet to pay for bills, it would all go into price. There would be no gain in real GDP. It would just result in rapidly escalating inflation. And eventually what would happen is that the aggregate supply curve would start shifting inward as more and more people went to try to operate with in a barter framework, which I don't know how we could even achieve a barter framework in this specialized world that exists today.
Well, and of course, that would probably create an opening for alternative currencies, whether they be cryptocurrencies or otherwise, to begin competing with government-issued currency on the argument that they're more stable and less subject to inflation.
Well, the main thing to understand is that Gresham's Law would take effect. In other words, the bad money, the Federal Reserve's liabilities, would chase out good money. People that could, take for example some of the cases where central bank liabilities were made legal tender. This was done by the Chiang Kai-shek government in 1935, and then it was done by the Weimar Republic in the 1920s. Done by Yugoslavia at the end of World War II, Hungary at the end of World War II, numerous cases in Latin America in the last 30 to 40 years, happened in Venezuela contemporarily. In the late days of the Roman Empire, there was no central bank, but what was done was the pure metallic coins were replaced by worthless metal coins. And people wouldn't use them, wouldn't accept them. So they resorted to barter, which even then was complicated. In the Bourbons of France, they had become extremely over-indebted to finance what was known as the 7 Years' War in Europe, the French and Indian War in the U.S., the American Revolution, and they continued living beyond their means. The government of Louis XVI was unpopular. They couldn't pay off these debts, but they continued their high living style. So they began issuing worthless metallic coins, same effect. So people that could move their assets into assets that held value, move some to foreign countries or what have you. But that would be very, very difficult in the current environment because the U.S. dollar is the reserve currency. So going along that route would be unimaginably disruptive, in my opinion. Deflation is an uncomfortable environment, but for those that are employed, real incomes generally tend to continue to rise at least somewhat. In hyperinflation, no one's real income will rise, and everyone would become miserable.
Well, Dr. Hunt, I wish that we could go on for hours. It's fascinating just to hear your musings on all of these interesting scenarios. Unfortunately, we're running out of time. So before I let you go, give us a quick overview of what you do at Hoisington Asset Management.
Well, I'm the chief economist of the company. We manage in excess of $4 billion of institutional fixed income money. We've been in business since 1980. We really don't have individual clients, but we are the sub-advisor to the Wasatch Hoisington Treasury Bond Fund, and you're able to get the same type of management in that fund, which is symbols WHOSX, as for our big institutional clients.
Well, Dr. Hunt, I can't thank you enough for a fantastic interview. I would love to hear you continue to muse on these subjects for hours, but we are unfortunately out of time. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it was great to have Dr. Lacey Hunt back onto the show. One of the things that I think we've heard it before on this show is his entire idea that the more debt that comes into the system, it actually causes lower interest rates, not higher interest rates over the long term. And that's so counterintuitive to what anyone would naturally think when approaching the bond markets. And when you really put it into that perspective, it really touches on this idea that maybe we are heading to a zero bound world where the Japanification of the American and European economies could actually be a real risk.
Well, Patrick, I think you hit the nail on the head, and it's so fascinating to me. I think Dr. Hunt makes a perfect argument, and it makes perfect sense, which is, look, if you're talking about emerging market debt, you know, little countries that are not systemically important to the international monetary system, definitely the way it works is too much debt causes a loss of confidence in that country's ability to repay that debt. That results in much higher yields. I don't think Dr. Hunt is disputing that for a second. But that's for little emerging market countries. What about major economies like the United States that are central to the global financial system? Well, in that case, the system tends to assume that it is impossible for there to be a default on U.S. Treasury debt. So if we know that's impossible, then we're not going to respond to the default risk. We're going to respond instead to the fact that if the economy is unable to afford higher bond yields, every time bond yields move higher, it's going to collapse the economy, and there's going to be a retreat out of risk assets back to safety, and it's going to support lower bond yields. This all makes sense, but you know, someday you have to get to a reckoning point where if the entire developed market economies and the global financial system is all in a Japanification where it's super low yields and economic stagnation, at what point does somebody just say, hey, even the major systemically important currencies of the world, like the dollar and the U.S. Treasury market, you know, this debt is unsustainable. It's, you know, at what level, Patrick, of national debt does the U.S. Treasury system just hit that point where the market says, wait a minute, this is unsustainable, even if it is the United States of America? Is it $20 trillion, $30 trillion, $40 trillion? I don't know, but it seems like politicians, whatever the number is, they're going to find out. They're going to keep borrowing until we test it. So it's going to be really interesting. In any event, I want to come back now to the foreign exchange topic that we discussed in the market wrap, because this move on the dollar index is clearly important. As some of our listeners have suggested in recent weeks, we really need to dive into what's driving it. So let's look at the underlying currency pairs that contribute to the dollar index and talk about what's going on here, both in developed and emerging markets. Listeners, you'll find the download link in your research roundup email. It says post-game chart book, or if you aren't yet registered, just go to our homepage at macrovoices.com. Look for the red button that says looking for the downloads next to Dr. Hunt's picture on our homepage. Patrick, diving into page two, we're looking at the dollar index on a weekly chart. Talk us through what we're looking at here.
Well, to the visible eye, any technician can identify that the dollar index on a weekly chart basis here has broken out. Now, the week isn't over, so there's always something that could happen the day after we're recording this on Thursday. But this is definitively a breakout. But it reminds me of the circumstance when we were talking about this back in November. So if we rewind a little bit earlier in 2018, we had a huge breakout in the dollar in August, in the middle of August of 2018. It made its high near about the 97 level. And then several months later, as we approached November, it actually broke to a higher high. And it was in the middle of November where we went and popped almost a 1 point higher, approaching but didn't print 98 on the upside. And we were asking the same question we are today. Is this the breakout? Is this the beginning of the next trend? And rather than that marking a new breakout, we ended up falling into a 6 month consolidation. And obviously, you were saying in the pregame that there was a number of our past guests that are attempting to even fade this dollar move. And that's a pretty bold thing. But I mean, it does remind me a lot of November. And back then, they would have been right. And so I'm dying to find out whether this breakout is for real. Because if it's for real, I don't see how this doesn't stop without a full retest of the 2016-2017 high on the dollar index at 104. And so I don't think it's going to take more than a couple of weeks for us to find out whether this actually turns into a big breakout with some serious momentum.
Well, Patrick, I think the key to this is there's two narratives that people are talking about. You can discuss the fundamentals of the U.S. dollar. That is to say, what should the U.S. dollar be doing relative to other currencies based on the usual factors of interest rate differentials and the health of the economy and so on and so forth. If you look at it that way, it's easy for me to see why some people are very dollar bearish and they have this view. But I think what's going on is it really, what I believe is truly driving this market is people are just starting to figure out Jeff Snyder's narrative, the one that says, look, this is not about the U.S. dollar being the white knight in shining armor that comes racing in because the U.S. economy is perfect and everything's great. This is about a dollar liquidity squeeze, which is driven by a breakdown in the functioning of the offshore euro dollar system that is not resulting in everybody thinking the dollar is a better currency. It's resulting in a dollar squeeze where we don't have a sufficient supply of dollars to satisfy the needs of the global economy, with the emphasis on global. This is about international capital flows. It's all about Jeff Snyder's interview that we just did last week. And I think what's going on here is people that were focused on that fundamentals of the dollar view are starting to come around and say, wait a minute, it's the Snyder story. That's the one that's actually governing here. And I think that when more people figure out that's what's happening, you could see a dramatic acceleration to the upside.
Right. And so on chart three, I want to move on here, Eric, because on chart three, I put up the chart of the euro. Now, this is important to me because as we've mentioned many times on the show, the dollar index is heavily weighted to the euro. Something like 57% of the index is made up of the euro. So in my mind, I was thinking, well, what could be a fake out? It could be a fake out if the move was only happening on the euro, but the other currencies were not confirming. And so here on page three, I just show the euro breakdown. And with the economic weakness we're seeing in Europe, it's certainly not out of line for this to continue back down towards its 2017 lows. I mean, it's a number we've seen just a few years ago. But what was fascinating to me was that there's a lot of other currencies that are weakening at the same time. Particularly, I don't have the Canadian dollar here, but the Canadian and Australian dollar on page four, I have the Aussie dollar there, are both weakening down to the bottom end of the ranges. Now, there was that one little mini flash crash liquidity event on the Aussie dollar that printed down toward under 68 cents. But overall, the vast majority of the volume that is traded on the Aussie dollar has been in this 70 to 72 cent range. And it really looks like that Aussie is rolling over and going to break down. And you're seeing that same pattern on the Canadian dollar and a number of the emerging market ones.
Okay, Patrick. So the question on my mind, we're seeing developed markets really confirming what the dollar index chart is showing us. What about emerging markets, though?
Well, this is the interesting part, is because the emerging markets are showing considerable weakness outside of those majors. When you start going onto the charts, such as I have the Brazilian real on here, it's now breaking multi-month lows and on the verge of heading back down to its 2018 low. On page six, we have the chart of the Argentinian peso. Obviously, Argentina has its own fundamental issues, but it is still making fresh multi-year lows here at these prices. You go to the Turkish lira, and the situation in Turkey continues to worsen, and the currency is once again breaking down to multi-month lows, heading almost looking like it's heading right back to those 2018 lows. Then we had this morning the bad economic data coming out from South Korea, and the South Korean won breaking down to new multi-year lows on this breakdown move. You have the Swedish koruna on bad economic news breaking to new multi-year lows. Like currency after currency are breaking down. And so I find it hard to suggest that this dollar is a fake out when you have so many currencies that are breaking down all simultaneously.
Well, Patrick, everything that you're saying completely confirms in my mind my strongest suspicion, which is I think this is not about fundamentals of currency trading. I think this is about a dollar short squeeze, and it's about a lack of there being sufficient dollars because of the breakdown in the offshore eurodollar system to supply the requirements of the global marketplace. And what it says to me is the dollar is going to continue to squeeze higher against everything, which is what's going on here.
Absolutely. So in my view, obviously, we're going to want to give the dollar the benefit of the doubt to kind of prove to us from a technical perspective that there's real follow through. But to me, there's a lot of holes in the dam and the water's starting to break through. I'm feeling that this, after a 6 month consolidation where the dollar has pretty much been in a sideways range, if this breaks out here, this could be one of the biggest macro events of 2019.
Patrick, I couldn't agree more, but let's move on now to the 10-year Treasury yield and look at what's going on there.
Well, you were talking about it earlier in the pregame, and I just wanted to use this as a foundation to talk about the next few topics. What I found fascinating, just off the cuff, notice the similar chart pattern on pages 10 and 11 between the path of the 10-year yield and the path of the spread between the euro dollar June and 2019 and June 2020 contracts. The spread is showing what the expected rate cuts are in the next 1 year. And it actually, the chart looks almost the same, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
And I don't really even know if I have a proper explanation why it would. But anyway, I continue to believe at this stage that yields are highly likely to go lower. And, you know, and we heard from Dr. Lacey Hunt as to why he feels that that is the case. And I have to agree in principle with him. But what I find fascinating is that we now have a Fed that's thrown in the towel. No more rate hikes on the table this year. They've basically already drawn out how they're going to stop contracting their balance sheet in the coming months. And we now have a euro dollar market that is still clearly pricing in a rate cut in the coming year, June over June. And that to me is the bond market continuing to signal the fact that we are seeing economic weakness ahead. And the slowdown is coming, very similar to Dr. Lacey Hunt's view. But what I find fascinating on pages 12 and 13, I have the credit spreads on investment grade debt over that of Treasury. And on page 13 is the high yield or junk bonds credit spread over Treasury. And what we have is a huge, or not huge, but a significant reversion back to levels where we were through 2017, 2018. And it's almost like the corporate credit markets are basically suggesting that there are no risks of a recession or slowdown, but yet we're getting a completely different message from the Treasury bond market. And I'm trying to square this in terms of which one is going to be proven right on this.
Well, this is utterly baffling to me because I don't have lost track of how many times I've said to myself, okay, this has to be it for high yield. It doesn't make any sense that we have junk spreads at 300 or 400 basis points when you look at just the ridiculous amount of junk bond issuance that has occurred since 2009. All of the triple Bs, we've talked quite a bit on this program about why there is so much both junk and slightly more than junk rated corporate debt that really just, it doesn't make sense. It's going to be unserviceable if we get into an economic downturn. It doesn't make sense that it is priced as high as it is, and the prices keep going higher. And every time that I've tried to short junk, it's blown up in my face, and I've been stopped out of the trade. So I cannot explain this, Patrick. I don't know if you can, but you know, how is it possible that we see all the signs that we're seeing that the economy is headed for recession? We're seeing much lower Treasury yields generally, but junk spreads are basically multi-year lows.
Well, you know what? Just like you were just suggesting right over there, that we've been down this road before, trying to call these major turning points. Luckily, I've moved to the sideline during the last plunge, but I'm very tempted here to give a shot to the downside for these junk bonds. At some stage, an economic slowdown should cause these credit spreads to blow out, and I think that people are being way too optimistic in this space. But time will find out, won't it?
It surely will. And I very much appreciate your putting together the chart deck. Folks, if you're not aware, Patrick puts together chart decks like this almost every day for his Big Picture Trading membership. If you're not already familiar with the service, I strongly encourage you to take advantage of the free 14-day free trial of Big Picture Trading. You can send an email to contact@bigpicturetrading.com or just go to www.bigpicturetrading.com. Patrick's company. Patrick runs daily webinars Monday through Thursday with similar chart books for his members where you can ask questions and so forth. So be sure to check out that complimentary service. Meanwhile, we need your help promoting Macro Voices. So please tell your friends and colleagues, forward your research roundup emails, and most importantly, register your free account at macrovoices.com. Only takes a few minutes, and the benefit to you is you'll receive our free research roundup email, which never contains any advertising or marketing. It's just links to the best content we could find on the internet each week. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's research roundup.
This week, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to the chart book we just discussed in the post game. There's also an interesting article from Variant Perception talking about the setback to that Turkish recovery, as well as an interesting article from Daniel Lecaille suggesting that the Eurozone slowdown is far worse than the global one. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's research roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend and myself at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices.
Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.